Welcome to the fifth episode in this series on applied cultural evolution. My name is Joe Brewer, and I am your host. I am also the director of the Center for Applied Cultural Evolution. The topic I want to discuss with you today is how the global ecological crisis can be understood as a process of runaway cultural evolution. This is something that has been discussed more briefly in a previous episode that I feel is important to clarify and unpack in more detail now. Let me begin by saying that right now there is a host of problems that we normally frame as being environmental in nature. And this is where we get into things like air pollution, water pollution, plastics filling up the marine ecosystems of the world's ocean, nitrogen runoff that creates algal blooms and what are called dead zones at the mouths of the world's rivers, or the penultimate of climate or of environmental issues, human-caused climate change. When we normally think about these environmental issues, there is a confusion that easily arises where sometimes the issues are thought of as being technical in nature and requiring solutions based in technology, while other times there's a focus on political institutions and the power structures that exist within them, or maybe having to do with business models and the logic of commerce in market-based societies. There might be other factors as well having to do with the unintended consequences of previously developed technologies, like the use of DDT that was used as an early pesticide without realizing that it would bioaccumulate and have harmful consequences higher up the food chain. The thing that I want to stress right now is that much of the confusion about the relationships between technology and cultural issues comes from a broader background of presumed separation for topics that were discussed in the previous episode about the need to integrate the social sciences. The thing that we're going to discuss today is what is cultural evolution when we think about the relationship between a biological organism and the environment that that organism resides within. Because there are some very interesting findings from work in cultural evolution that extend from and are related to the study of animal behavior in non-human species. So first, let me re-share what cultural evolution is. In its broadest terms, cultural evolution is the application of Darwinian evolution as understood in biology that is properly modified to explain cultural phenomena. So, the approach taken by Charles Darwin and later adopted in what's called the modern synthesis in biology can be thought of simply in this way, that in any population of a given species, there will be diversity of physical and behavioral traits. There might be some organisms that have lighter colors or darker colors, different patterns of color, or there may be different morphological structures like the size of the jaw or the length of the antenna or things like this that are physical in quality. There might be behavioral aspects, like the ability to perceive and communicate with different modes of information. But the important thing is that there is variety that already exists within the population. And then there's the fairly intuitive observation that some combinations of those traits will be better suited to the environment than others. And so there should be a statistical phenomenon of selecting for or having a slight bias for the things that are better suited to the environment than the things that are less well suited. So Darwinian evolution can simply be understood as a process of natural selection upon existing variety within a given environment that increases the composition of that population over time with each passing generation, such that the remaining surviving individuals within a population are statistically more likely to be well-suited to their environment than those who came before. And over long periods of time, we end up with an entire population of organisms highly adapted to their environments through this process. When we take this way of thinking and pass it over to the cultural realm, we can start by realizing that this is a simple extension of what I just said for communication and behavior, except that it adds the features of culture that may or may not exist in organisms that do not have a cultural repertoire. So these are things like having the ability to communicate using language where there can be concepts and metaphors, or where there may be social norms and social conventions with rituals associated with them, where members of the community learn how to behave within their population. This is where we get into interesting differences between the genetic capacities for instincts and the psychological capacities for learning. So if you have an ant that is able to communicate by laying down a chemical that it excretes from glands on its body that other members of its population can smell or feel and use to navigate in their environment, this could be driven entirely by genetics using rigidly structured and wired behavioral responses that are instinctual or genetically determined. But when we look at something like human behavior, we see that a huge amount of our psychological capabilities are not hardwired and instinctual, but instead are open-ended and able to change and can be modified by experience, meaning that we have the psychological flexibility to learn and therefore behave differently. This begins us on a pathway toward understanding cultural evolution, where we can think about what the environmental factors are that influence how psychological flexibility plays out, or said in more everyday terms, how does a community of people change when members of that community can learn from each other? There are two things to separate at this point to help us understand how cultural evolution relates to environmental problems. One thing is something that I've already mentioned, that cultural evolution can play out by having the flexibility to change behavior and therefore adopt behaviors that are better suited to the environment by learning them from others in the community. So there may be a particular way of casting a net to catch fish on an island community where fishing is an important way of getting protein and food for the survivors in that community. So the ability to learn how to cast such a net or how to make such a net would be very important and would likely spread across the population. But there's another piece, which is that the social environment where this learning occurs becomes an environment on which evolutionary processes can play out. So what this means is that not only can we have adaptation to the physical or ecological environment, that is the landscape that the people are living within, but also there's a factor that comes in, which is the role of the social environment as a way of shaping evolutionary processes. The reason this is important for the environmental issues that were outlined at the beginning of this episode is that our ability to respond socially to learning processes within our communities can create two kinds of effects that impact the environment. One effect is that if we change our behavior, we change the thermodynamics and the flows of nutrients through our social environments. What I mean by this is that we change how we use the environment, and so therefore we create changes in the environment. So we can have consequences that are unintended by our actions as we adopt a new social practice. The other way that the cultural evolutionary process shapes the environment is that we are able to develop and build upon what we learned before. Cultural evolution researchers sometimes call this the ratchet effect, because just as a ratchet will have a series of structural pieces that as you move from one to the next, it's difficult to go back, but now you can build on the new structure that's in place. It is possible to build upon and accumulate from the social learnings that happened before. Without going into the details of all of the research in this area, I'll simply summarize that there is very little evidence that this ratcheting effect happens in non-human species. Yet there is a tremendous amount of evidence that humans use this ratcheting process to accumulate cultural changes over time. So what does this have to do with the environment? Well, as we alter the evolution of our communities by responding to our social environments, our social environments simultaneously can build up increasingly sophisticated modes of social organization and technologies that are capable of being built and deployed. Said another way, we become adapters of our environments, just as the adaptations within us enable us to thrive within them. So over time, a process of cultural evolution will build up such that the community of people has very sophisticated modes of social learning and very complex tools and kinds of organization that they can use to cooperate and compete with each other within their communities. And that as all of this is happening, the environment becomes changed by it. So it is possible to select a social behavior or the use of a tool that alters the environment in a way that's beneficial to the community, yet may have unintended consequences that are negative on the environment itself. Thought of in this way, the emission of greenhouse gases, which is a principal contributor to global warming, can simply be thought of as a consequence of a cultural evolutionary process. Here we can think of a very complex meshwork of economic, political, technical, and social development all working out together to create a globalized industrial and post-industrial society that uses fossil fuels as a robust energy source for many of its needs. As the institutions and technologies developed that were capable of mining and extracting fossil fuels, and then processing and converting them for various social needs, the environment was changed. The emission of greenhouse gases being one of the changes in the environment, another being the release of plastics into our water supply, or the release of toxic chemicals into the air, or the alteration of landscapes as our population grows and we cut down forests and replace them with urban landscapes. So the key thing here is that there is no separation between biology and society. There is no separation between genetic evolution and behavioral, social, and ultimately cultural evolution. The key thing that is being missed by most people who don't understand cultural evolution is the inability to see the specific concrete mechanisms through which social change occurs that lead to the environmental harms, and also that might be employed or worked with and altered to change the course of social change to address environmental problems. Now notice as I say this that I'm not simply suggesting that we engage in campaigns to change people's behavior, because changing behavior alone will not be sufficient. Why is that the case? The reason that's the case is that changing behavior without understanding the system-level complexities of evolution means that we will again be unaware of the system-level consequences of changes in our behavior. Only when we learn how to see the adoption of cultural traits, including social behaviors, as a meshwork of inheritance systems, where we inherit new genetics in the surviving populations in each generation, Also, we inherit new behavioral repertoires or ways of behaving and acting in the world, which includes all of our technologies. But also, we gain environments of selection, meaning that our social settings themselves become the environments that evolution plays out within. And all of these inheritance processes play into and influence each other. So if we try to change behaviors to deal with an environmental problem without seeing how the evolutionary process plays out, we will remain unaware of the larger systems that we're working within. But if we begin to learn how cultural evolution really works and start to look at the specific adaptations that persist and get reproduced or inherited from one generation to the next, across a cascade of levels in scale and complexity, we begin to see how environmental problems are merely the inability to look at systemic consequences of our behaviors. And that if we have desired environmental outcomes in the future, what we need to do is change the system dynamics of emerging patterns that give rise to evolutionary change. All of this may sound very abstract, and in some ways it is, but let me give a very concrete example. Right now, we are unable to deal with the problem of global warming, in part because there is a meshwork of locked-in institutional structures. There's a very powerful fossil fuel industry and related manufacturing industries, like those for automobiles, as one example, pharmaceuticals being another. And this meshwork of industries that depends upon fossil fuels at present has accumulated a tremendous amount of infrastructure, of wealth, and of access to political decision makers. In an environment like this, where there is structural parts of the society that select for what changes can happen and strongly select against the changes that would threaten or undermine the structures that exist, then we find that attempts to do something like change the individual lifestyle choices of people around consumer products is grossly inadequate to the problem at hand. So here we have a situation where a multi-leveled cultural evolution process gave rise to a global architecture and infrastructure for civilization based on fossil fuels. And yet, when social sciences are applied to this problem of global warming, they tend to focus very myopically and reductionistically on the individual behaviors of people, like trying to get those who drive their cars to work to instead ride a bicycle or walk. I say all of this because the ecological crisis right now is the emergent patterns of a global complex system. And what has happened with the rise in sophistication and capacities of humans to alter our evolutionary landscapes by having more complex societies ourselves is that we have become a major driver of change for the entire planet. One of the terms for this in geology is to say that humans have become a geomorphic force. Geo meaning earth and morphic meaning shaping. Humans now shape the earth. Literally, we shape its chemistry, we shape its landscapes, we shape the composition of its air and its oceans, its soils, its waterways. Humans are a geomorphic force, a geomorphic agent acting upon the world. And it is cultural evolution that has made us so powerful. It is also cultural evolution that holds the power to drive us to extinction, while also taking to extinction many millions of other species in a potential mass extinction event. So as we think about the environmental problems that humanity is dealing with in our 21st century globalized world, if we fail to recognize how cultural evolution works, or we never realize that it's something we need to understand in the first place, then we fly blind in the face of existential risk. We potentially could drive ourselves to death without having a basic understanding of how we did it. I see this as the grand challenge for cultural evolution to be applied in this century. And it is something that the Center for Applied Cultural Evolution was set up to address. I realize that in a podcast like this, you don't get enough detail about cultural evolution to be able to address such a challenge. That's not the purpose of this episode. All I hope to do here is to plant the seed that you might want to learn more about cultural evolution as you deal with environmental problems, because it is a tremendous integrating and clarifying framework for seeing how all of the pieces fit together. And with that, I hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you, and have a nice day.